Thank you, everybody who is joining us. I am going to cover some quick housekeeping rules before we jump into the training today. My name is Nicole Henderson. I'll be your moderator today for the training. The training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Kluwin for those not able to join the live session. The Kluwin training page also has the slides available for download. While in Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window. We ask that you use the Q&A to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time during today's training. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available at the end of the training guide by completing the feedback form. I will put the feedback form link into the chat for you. You will load that as a web browser in your web browser. Complete the feedback form, and in the bottom right-hand corner, click the box to certify that you participated today, and the feedback form will be emailed to you. So, on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, an overview of the tire-derived chemicals 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. Again, my name is Nicole Henderson, and I am your moderator. I will be helping to respond to any of your technical problems in the background today. So please feel free to use that Q&A box to communicate with me. The training today is an overview of the associated online guidance document that was produced by ITRC in 2024. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Kluwin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses like the one you are in today. If you would like to become a member of ITRC, we encourage you to visit the website or contact us directly. On the website, you can learn about the organization, register for teams, and check out further trainings. The ITRC full disclaimer is also on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review the disclaimer in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government, and ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. Here on slide five, I'm excited to introduce our trainers for today. All of them supported the development of the ITRC resource and volunteered to be trainers during that process. I do also want to note that we have several people joining us from the team that will be in the background supporting questions, and we encourage you to submit your specific questions around the topic into the Q&A, and we are happy to be working in the background to get you some answers from our experts. And I also want to do a quick disclaimer that before we dive in and I hand this over to Katrina, some links presented in today's training may be broken or out of date. If you run into any issues accessing a link through the training, don't worry. You can always navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents on the left-hand navigation to find the specific sections we are referencing. And at this time, I am going to ask Katrina to come in and get us started on an overview of 6-PPD.
Thank you. Hello. For decades, coho salmon in the Pacific Northwest have experienced mass mortality events as they move through urban centers to natural streams. These mortality events are accompanied by distinct symptoms, including gasping at the water's surface, fin splaying, and loss of equilibrium. These die-offs were found to coincide with storms and urban stormwater runoff. But despite the dire consequences for salmon populations, the chemical or compounds responsible remained elusive. While research focused on mitigation, Source control could not be addressed while the mystery compound remained undiscovered. Then, in 2020, a research lab in Washington State made a breakthrough. They identified the compound responsible, 6-PPD-1L. PPD and 6-PPD quinone are contaminants of emerging concern, and the science is rapidly evolving. So there are many data gaps and unknowns. The current knowledge and what we don't know yet will be discussed within each presentation subtopic. A 2011 paper documented a multi-year effort to observe creeks in the Puget Sound watershed with the goal of understanding pre-spawning mortality. Up to 100% of coho salmon died before they could spawn in urban creeks. In female carcasses, there was a greater than 90% egg retention, indicating that they died before they spawned. These mortality events were correlated with urban road runoff and were termed urban runoff mortality syndrome. But the specific chemicals in the runoff responsible remained unknown. Until in 2018, a team of researchers at the University of Washington Tacoma Center for Urban Waters and Washington State University's Washington Stormwater Center started using high-resolution mass spectrometry to try to identify the contaminants contained within tire wear particle leachate. Over 2,000 chemicals were identified. Through a series of numerous chemical fractionation processes and approximately 3 years of work, the researchers discovered the 6-PPD quinone in 2020. This discovery was groundbreaking and led to an all-hands-on-deck approach to prevent 6-PPD quinone from reaching coho salmon. Later work showed that certain trout and char species also had high sensitivity to 6-PPD quinone. So, what is 6-PPD quinone and where does it come from? 6-PPD is used as an antiozonant and an antioxidant in tires to prevent cracking and increase the longevity of the tires. 6-PPD is directly responsible for tires meeting some of the tire performance regulations. 6-PPD is assumed to be present in all tires due to their superior functionality of this chemical and compared to other chemicals. 6-PPD is also found in post-consumer sources made of recycled tires, like crumb rubber for turf fields, playgrounds, rubber mulch for gardens, and rubber floor mats, car floor mats, for example. Here we see 6-PPD chemical structures. 6-PPD quinone is a transformation product of 6-PPD and is formed when 6-PPD reacts with ozone and other oxidizing compounds. 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone have different chemical properties that will be explained in more detail later in this presentation. The main source of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone to the environment is believed to be tire wear particles. Here we have our timeline. The use of 6-PPD in commercial tires began in the 1960s, and mortality of coho salmon was first documented in the 1980s and continues today. Research focused on the environmentally and culturally importance of coho salmon, but in 2018, researchers started looking at other salmonoid species. But the cause was still unknown. It wasn't until 2020 that 6-PPD quinone was discovered and determined to be the cause of mortality in the coho salmon. More recently, in 2023, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, granted a tribal petition to have 6-PPD banned under Section 21 of the Toxic Substance Control Act, better known as TSCA. Then in 2024, Washington State set the first aquatic life criteria value for 6-PPD quinone. This map shows the habitat of coho salmon across the country, both native, represented in blue, and non-native, shown in orange. Before toxicity data on other fish were available, the 6-PPD quinone problem wasn't viewed as a national issue, given the limited distribution of the known systems species of salmon. But this is not just an issue for the Pacific Northwest, as sensitive species are found throughout the United States and globally. Since its discovery, 6-PPD quinone has been found to be acutely toxic to brook, rainbow, steelhead trout, lake trout, and coastal cutthroat trout, which are important ecological and recreational species throughout the United States. 6-PPD quinone is now recognized as a global contaminant, and in June of 2024, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency issued non-regulatory and non-binding screening levels for 6-PPD quinone. Governments at various levels here in the United States and globally are increasingly recognizing the impacts of 6-PPD quinone, and they're moving toward regulations. The impacts to tribal nations. Some tribal nations have treaty rights guaranteeing a right to fish and manage salmon. The toxicity of 6-PPD quinone to coho salmon and aquatic life threaten that right and raise concerns about nation-to-nation rights and responsibilities. Tribal nations, both with and without treaty rights, have expressed concern for any impacts to the salmonoid fisheries, in part because salmon are culturally significant to many tribal nations in the Pacific Northwest. Salmon not only are important for diet of some tribal nations, but are part of a cultural practice, such as shown here in the slide by a member of a Yakama Nation who's using the traditional drip netting to catch, in this case, Chinook salmon. Some tribal nations from this region even identify as salmon peoples, elevating the significance of the salmon well beyond an important food source. Salmon may also be an important part of the economy to some tribal nations. Because spawning salmon are key food source and ecosystems, as well as to the members of tribes, some have expressed concern about secondary exposures from eating salmon that may contain 6-BPD quinone. Salmon are also threatened by concurrent threats such as climate change, habitat loss, and migration barriers. Tribal nations are commonly leading advocates for salmon protection and have always been involved in conversation efforts and research information into urban mortality runoff syndrome and 6-BPD quinone. These tribal nations continue to advance discussion, research, and policy. Here we have a conceptual exposure model which shows pyrrole particles containing 6-BPD quinone can be transported through air or stormwater runoff. The particles can be inhaled and they can also be deposited on surfaces, on soils, and plants. 6-BPD quinone in surface waters can be ingested and absorbed by fish. Exposed organisms can be ingested by humans and other species. The research is ongoing to define 6-BPD quinone's environmental behaviors, exposures, and the potential development of adverse health effects. Research is also ongoing on how to mitigate measures like green storm infrastructure, excuse me, stormwater infrastructure, which can potentially reduce the 6-BPD quinone transport to aquatic systems. What we don't know. The ITRC guidance documents and training cover what we know to date. 6-BPD and 6-BPD quinone are contaminants of emerging concern, and the research is rapidly evolving. The guidance document provides information that was current as of spring of 2024. Many questions are being answered while some data gaps remain. So far, only a handful of aquatic species have been tested for toxicity to 6-BPD quinone. The mechanism by which it causes toxicity is not fully understood. The human health effects associated with exposure to these contaminants is relatively unstudied. That research is still in its infancy, and knowledge gaps remain related to the toxicological concerns for humans. Widespread sampling has yet to begin. Therefore, our understanding of tire rubber, tire wear particles, 6-BPD, 6-BPD quinone, and their movement through the environment is limited until we have a better understanding of the physicochemical properties, fate and transport, the occurrence and human exposure. Until we know these, we will not know the totality of social and cultural impact. So next, I'd like to hand this over to Alan, who will be talking about the effects of characterization and toxicology.
Thank you so much, Katrina. Hi, everybody. I'm Alan. In this section, we hope you'll learn which species are known to be sensitive to 6-BPD quinone, what we do and what we do not know about 6-PPD quinone's toxicity to aquatic life, and that ecological risk is a combination of the hazard or toxicity of the chemical, as well as the exposure or concentrations available for environmental exposure. Finally, in this section, we'll talk about what we do and do not know about 6-PPD quinone and risks to human health. Next slide, please. Although 6-PPD quinone was only discovered about 4 years ago, there has been considerable amount of toxicity testing data developed for this compound in the last few years. The main focus has been on acute lethality to fish, with limited chronic sublethal testing on fish and limited acute and chronic testing in other aquatic organisms. There is almost no data yet on terrestrial species, including humans, which we'll talk about in a few slides. From the data gathered thus far, we do know that there is variation both between different species and within a species, with clear differences in toxicity to different life stages. Importantly, we don't yet know the toxic mode of action, as Katrina pointed out, of 6-PPD quinone, or how various environmental factors or co-stressors such as temperature might affect toxicity. Next slide, please. So what does the data we've collected so far show? Of the species tested, salmonids or salmon, trout, and char are apparently the most sensitive. Coho salmon, as shown here, are the most sensitive, with LC50s in the nanogram per liter or parts per trillion range. This table shows coho salmon as the most sensitive, and I do want to point out that the units shown here are micrograms per liter, so parts per billion. So that's a thousandfold higher than parts per trillion. The LC50 is the exposure concentration lethal to half the study population. This is one of the lowest LC50s ever identified, ever measured in aquatic organisms. As a point of reference, 80 nanograms per liter is the equivalent to 4 drops of 6-PPD quinone in an entire Olympic-sized swimming pool. This LC50 is well below concentrations frequently measured in urban stormwater runoff. 6-PPD quinone has been measured as high as 2.85 micrograms per liter. Again, trying to standardize the units as micrograms per liter. And the onset of symptoms often occurs within 90 minutes of exposure. Please bear in mind that this is only acute toxicity, does not reflect the potential for chronic or sublethal effects. Next slide, please. This slide shows that several other Salmonid species have been shown to be very sensitive, although not as extraordinarily sensitive as the coho salmon. The color changes shown represent orders of magnitude changes in the LC50s. While not quite as lethal as to coho, these LC50s are still considered to be highly toxic to multiple Salmonid species. Next slide, please. Moving on to other species, there are other Salmonids that show very low to no acute toxicity from higher concentrations measured in the environment. Once again, please bear in mind that this is only acute toxicity, does not reflect the potential for chronic or sublethal effects. You may have noticed that we are showing the test duration in this slide for these data. This is to show that these numbers are not necessarily directly comparable, because different exposure and durations means that the fish were exposed to the various concentrations of 6-PPD quinone for different lengths of time. It's also important to think about in terms of environmental exposures. Fish are exposed during rain events when 6-PPD quinone is going to wash into surface waters. In those rain events, and elevated concentrations may vary quite markedly in time from a few hours to even several days. Next slide, please. Other than salmonids, no fish have shown acute mortality at environmentally relevant concentrations. In addition, 6-PPD quinone does not seem to be toxic to daphnids, which we call water fleas, or a growing list of other invertebrates such as the amphipod Hyalella. So it's not toxic to everything. Next slide, please. As I mentioned earlier, we also know that sensitivity to 6-PPD quinone varies not just among different species, but also within a single species, depending on age. For example, eggs seem to be generally less sensitive, possibly because the chorion, the protective membrane enveloping embryos, potentially mitigates uptake to the embryo. Comparing different independent studies, we also see age-dependent toxicity in coho salmon, with LC50s ranging from about 41 nanograms per liter, parts per trillion, in newly feeding approximately three-week-old post-swim-up hatchlings to 95 nanograms per liter in over 1 year old. So quite a range there. Next slide, please. Surprisingly, sensitivity to 6 ppd quinone does not seem to be strongly correlated with genetic relationships. This is a phylogenetic tree. Sorry, it's a little busy, but I'll try to explain it. It's a phylogenetic tree showing how various tested fish are related. The pattern of branching shown here reflects how the species evolved from a series of common ancestors. Species are more related if they have a more recent common ancestor, such as Chinook and coho salmon, and less related if they have a less recent common ancestor, such as zebrafish and coho. As seen from this diagram, we see that closely related species do not necessarily share sensitivity or tolerance to 6 ppd quinone. This lack of correlation makes it difficult or even impossible to predict toxicity to untested species with any sort of accuracy, which can create a real headache for those doing risk assessment. Next slide, please. So how does 6 ppd quinone kill salmonids so quickly? We still don't know for sure, but there are now a few hypotheses. Let me summarize some of those. In early experiments on roadway runoff before the identification of 6 ppd quinone, researchers found that the vasculature of the dying coho leaked. Plasma leaking from the gills and plasma also leaked into the brain, indicating failure of the blood-brain barrier. Genes important for blood vessel architecture are also dysregulated in coho exposed to 6 ppd quinone, which further supports this hypothesis. A second hypothesis is that mitochondrial dysfunction might be the mode of toxicity. In in vitro testing of different rainbow trout cell lines, gill cells died after exposure to 6 ppd quinone, while liver cells did not. And this correlated with oxygen consumption rates, which increased in the gill cells, but not in the liver cells. This is consistent with some cases of mitochondrial dysfunction. Yet a third hypothesis is that toxicity is related to metabolism or biotransformation. Higher concentrations of native 6 ppd quinone seem to be correlated with increased toxicity in several studies, suggesting that survival might depend on an organism's ability to biotransform PPD quinones to less toxic metabolites. In summary, the mode of action could be any of these hypotheses or even a combination of them. The bottom line is we still need more research to really understand the molecular initiating event and how these effects follow. Next slide, please. Acute mortality is not the only toxic effect that could have population level effects, but the sublethal effects of 6 ppd quinone have only started to be explored. The species listed on this slide are just the few that have been tested thus far. A few recent papers have shown that 6 ppd quinone has some developmental toxicity and delayed mortality in several salmonids exposed as embryos and alevin, which are hatchlings. One paper has shown that 6 ppd quinone exposure resulted in remodeling of the gills, reducing the surface area available for oxygen exchange, despite needing more energy, which may disrupt the energy balance of the fish. We can see the difference in gill structure and surface area in between control and 6 ppd quinone exposed fingerlings in these gill histology images on this slide. Several papers have also shown a variety of sublethal effects in zebrafish, which are very tolerant to acute effects of 6 ppd quinone. While some of these effects only occurred at exposure concentrations above those found in surface water, several studies suggest that early life exposure to 6-PPD quinone may cause behavioral changes in environmentally relevant concentrations, which indicates that even tolerant species may experience adverse effects with the potential to affect populations. Next slide, please. In general, it appears that 6-PPD is far less acutely toxic than 6-PPD quinone, although its low stability and formation of transformation products makes its toxicity hard to study. Next slide. All these toxicity studies have enabled development of water quality benchmarks or thresholds for 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. We'll talk about these more in the training module policies, regulations, and laws coming up a bit later. For now, just note that these are protective thresholds, and so they are actually lower than the COHO LC50 of 0.05 nanograms per liter discussed earlier. Those astoundingly low guidelines. In this slide, it shows that we're also interested in potential human health impacts in addition to impacts of other species. This is the same diagram we showed earlier with focus on human health exposure pathways. If we look back to the conceptual model, we now notice there are a lot of potential routes of human exposure to tire particles that contain and release 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, as well as the chemicals themselves. Next slide, please. We know that 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone are present in humans. Biomonitoring studies in China have detected both chemicals in urine and blood serum. A study on human breast milk found 6-PPD in half the samples, but 6-PPD quinone was below the limit of quantification in all samples. A study on a small number of Parkinson's disease patients found 6-PPD quinone in cerebrospinal fluid, which did not analyze for 6-PPD. From these studies and studies using mouse models, we know that 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone can move around in humans and potentially also transmit from parent to fetus and cross the blood-brain barrier. However, we still have limited information about potential for bioaccumulation or what this exposure might mean for human health. We do know that humans have the potential for exposure from a study by Du et al. In 2022, which detected 6-PPD in human urine. This is further illustrated in a guidance document. The most striking result is that pregnant women had significantly higher levels in urine. The explanation for this is unclear. They might have higher exposure or they may excrete more of it per unit of exposure. Next slide, please. There's very little information on the toxicity of 6-PPD quinone to humans, as has been stated earlier. Because 6-PPD has been used for a while, we know a bit more about it. 6-PPD can cause skin allergies. It's classified by the European Chemicals Energy as a reproductive toxicant. There is also some evidence from rat and mouse studies that chronic exposure to 6-PPD can lead to hepatotoxicity. For 6-PPD quinone, we have only a few mouse studies so far, which have also indicated potential for liver toxicity, hepatotoxicity. Studies in other model organisms have also shown potential for neurotoxicity, reproductive and developmental toxicity, and even carcinogenicity. But the relevance to human health of these observed effects remains unclear. Next slide, please. To sum up, the toxicity of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone is an active field of research with new papers coming out all the time. What we do know so far is that 6-PPD quinone is likely toxic to coho and other salmonids at very low concentrations, although we still do not fully understand the toxic mode of action or how other species are more sensitive than others, a wide variety of toxicity. We know that sublethal exposures can also cause toxic effects, but we're only beginning to understand what those may be. And while we have a decent amount of data on salmonids, we still don't know much about effects on other aquatic and terrestrial organisms. In general, 6-PPD is apparently less toxic than 6-PPD quinone but it is difficult to study because of its chemical properties. Finally, we know people are exposed to 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, but we do not yet understand what this means in terms of human health. And now I'm going to pass it over to Rachel to talk about occurrence, fate, transport, as well as measuring, mapping, and modeling. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Alan. All right, so in this section, we're going to talk about the sources of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, how they are released into the environment, where the compounds have been detected, and we'll also highlight the data gaps and unknowns related to the fate and transport. Understanding the occurrence of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone necessitates a discussion of tire and road wear particles. These particles are generated by friction with the road and tires during normal driving conditions. Tire and road wear particles are then carried beyond the road surface by a stormwater or another pathway like air dispersion or deposition, and it enters the aquatic or the terrestrial ecosystems. The occurrence and persistence of these particles and chemicals is currently poorly understood, with the fate and transport mechanisms that control the occurrence varying among landscapes, with the geography, with climate, and with different environmental conditions. Understanding the physical and chemical properties is important for discussions of fate and transport. An in-depth discussion of these properties is available in the ITRC guidance document and includes properties that are measured in the environment and some that are still theoretical. Therefore, knowledge about these properties will continue to evolve. There are some key differences between 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, meaning they will behave differently in the environment. In terms of solubility, 6-PPD is more soluble in water. This is the compound that is added to the tire. Now, the transformation product, the 6-PPD quinone, is still sufficiently soluble to be transported by water until it is captured by organic matter. In terms of the half-life, transformation product 6-PPD quinone is more stable in water with a half-life of weeks versus just less than a day for the half-life of 6-PPD. More research is needed to understand the half-life under varying environmental conditions. One final aspect to note is that 6-PPD quinone is hydrophobic. It preferentially binds to organic matter and can sorb to plastic containers. Since the discovery of 6-PPD quinone in 2020, there has been an increasing number of peer-reviewed studies about the occurrence of 6-PPD quinone and also 6-PPD. Additional information can be found in the guidance document, tables 4-1 through 4-10, where each media type has a table and a summary of the study. These studies are from peer-reviewed literature and do not capture the preliminary monitoring efforts by states, tribal, and local agencies. When interpreting the available data, it is important to consider that the fate and transport is impacted by regional specific conditions. As illustrated by the figure, there are currently limited studies on groundwater, drinking water, and roadside soil, but stormwater, surface waters, and dust have many publications. We will highlight key areas of occurrence data, focusing on the transport and the exposure pathways. We will first highlight surface water and storm water, which are the major mechanisms for transporting tire and road wear particles and the associated chemicals 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone into receiving surface water, where the concentrations of 6-PPD quinone can be observed above the lethal levels for coho salmon. You will note a range in the reported concentrations, and more studies are needed to understand how environmental conditions, such as the landscape, the watershed, and the stormwater characteristics affect the fate and transport. There is limited data about which stormwater and water treatment technologies are most effective at preventing the transport of these particles and chemicals. In many places in the U.S., stormwater is not treated before it is discharged to surface waters. Tire-derived contaminants are washed into water bodies during storm events, which may lead to a temporary peak in 6-PPD quinone concentrations. The storm hydrograph shows the black line of rise and fall in the 6-PPD quinone concentration versus the stormwater discharge in blue. One potent dose in a single storm is enough to cause acute effects in sensitive fish species, even if the average concentrations are very low. This is a key difference of 6-PPD quinone relative to other stormwater contaminants. A current study should take this into account, as a single time point grab sample may not represent an ecologically relevant concentration if you miss the peak. It is important to note that the peak in concentration can vary by the river, the stream, and the watershed. In larger rivers and watersheds, peak concentration of 6-PPD quinone may not be observed for many hours after the initial storm. In smaller tributaries with high amounts of impervious surfaces, peak concentrations may occur in the first hour and are easy to miss. The greater the percentage of impervious surfaces within the stream catchment, the more difficult it is to capture the pollutant peak. Stormwater and surface water transport the tire and road wear particles, and as is shown in the figure, 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone have been detected in river, estuary, coastal, and deep sea sediments. There are also detections in roadside soil with observed biodegradation, and the models and measurements of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone suggest ready binding to soil and organics. Additional studies are needed to understand the relationship between the suspended concentration versus what is deposited onto the soil and sediments. Research is ongoing to fill this data gap about the deposition, the composition, the biodegradation, and these transformation processes. Standardized methods for measuring the tire and road wear particles in the water and sediments are challenging, and 6-PPD quinone may provide a proxy for tire-derived microplastics that could represent a continued source of 6-PPD or 6-PPD quinone in the environment. Tire and road wear particles can disperse 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone into the air. These particles exist as a variety of size fractions, with the diagram illustrating how small the tire particles can be. The larger 50 to 90 micron particles, which are shown in blue and green, will deposit near roadways, while the smaller 2.5 to 10 micron particles shown in yellow and white can remain suspended in the air and be inhaled by organisms. Tire and road wear particles increase with proximity to roads, with 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone being detected in particulate matter along roads, in outdoor air, and in indoor settled dust. More research is needed to better understand the airborne exposure pathways in humans and in terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. A substantial knowledge gap exists regarding the presence of 6-PPD quinone and 6-PPD within edible fish tissue and other aquatic biota consumed by humans, as well as whether these levels are sufficiently elevated to pose a risk to human health. Determining the concentrations in aquatic food sources and assessing the impact of various cooking techniques is important for evaluating any potential human exposure and establishing informed consumption guidelines. It is unknown whether the ingestion of non-aquatic food sources will expose the consumer to these chemicals. Preliminary studies have shown the uptake of 6-PPD, but not 6-PPD quinone, into leafy greens, but more studies are needed to fill this knowledge gap. It is not yet known whether 6-PPD or 6-PPD quinone pose a bioaccumulation risk. Early indications are the bioaccumulation potential is low to moderate. Direct toxicity probably poses the greatest ecological risk. More research is needed to confirm bioavailability and bioaccumulation for both compounds in different species. Potential routes of human exposure from contact with consumer products may include dermal contact, the inhalation of particles, or accidental ingestion of particles, and also depends on the product and the usage pattern. Additional information is available in section 4.6 of the guidance document. And as you can see in this image, it includes many daily use common consumer products. So occurrence, feed, and transport studies have confirmed that 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone are present in watersheds, urban runoff, sediment, air, dust, and snow, confirming some of the routes of exposure in this conceptual model. And so we'll now discuss measuring, mapping, and modeling. And I'm going to give us like a 2 second breath while we switch gears here. All right. Now, as we switch gears and start talking about studying these compounds. All right. So in this section, we'll highlight considerations for the study design. Mapping tools can assist in locating sampling locations. We'll talk about aspects to consider for field sampling, measuring and laboratory analysis, modeling tools that can predict hotspots or concentrations of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. So measuring, mapping, and modeling are critical tools to understand the occurrence, fate, and transport of contaminants. Every contaminant has special considerations, and we will discuss adapting protocols and approaches for 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. Briefly, mapping tools help focus sampling and mitigation efforts, providing a visualization that can be used to inform the sampling locations. These locations can then be sampled according to standard or protocols or best known practices and sent to a laboratory for analysis. Data is then used to validate models and to make predictions about the occurrence. Studies continue to repeat this process to advance knowledge about the occurrence, transport, and risk. So mapping tools can help focus sampling by locating 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone hotspots or potentially vulnerable ecological populations. Key mapping layers that inform sampling locations can include urban areas with high traffic patterns, watershed characteristics with precipitation data, and the habitat of sensitive species. Additional information is available about mapping tools and data layers in Section 5 of the guidance document. But as examples, we'll highlight a state, a federal, and a risk mapping tool that can be used to inform sampling. So the first tool we're highlighting is the Washington Department of Ecology Story Map, and it's a state-level mapping tool to identify potential hotspots of 6-PPD quinone near salmon-bearing water bodies, which can all help focus sampling efforts. A state-level view is available, with the areas of interest for 6-PPD quinone sampling shown in dark blue. You can zoom to a stream of specific interest to see additional information and a vulnerability score. The US EPA Freshwater Explorer is a federal level tool highlighting streams that are in close proximity to impervious surfaces. When zooming in on a specific location, this mapping tool highlights in red and yellow streams that are near roadways. These locations could have high concentrations of 6-PPD or 6-PPD quinone during runoff events. And the final one we're going to highlight is a Roads to Ruin paper developed a risk mapping tool that visualizes locations in Washington that could be predicted to have high coho mortality. This is currently being updated and a new version will be released soon. So once locations of interest have been identified, sampling can commence. General guidance for field sampling is available in Chapter 5 of the guidance document. And recalling some of the physical and chemical properties, 6-PPD will be anticipated to have a lower detection frequency because of a half-life of less than a day. 6-PPD quinone is hydrophobic and can sorb to plastic material. Contact time should be limited with plastic materials during sampling and analysis. 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone can both interact with suspended solids. As long as contact time with plastic materials is minimized, sampling can be done with grab, automated, and passive sampling. Selection of the sampling type will depend on the goals of the project and the ability to time sampling with a storm or a runoff event. Sampling in streams and during urban runoff provides environmentally relevant concentrations to be compared with the lab toxicity studies that we discussed. Recalling the hydrograph, the increase and then decrease in concentration should be considered when planning sampling events for 6-PPD quinone. Because 6-PPD quinone is not a persistent organic contaminant, sampling must be timed after the rainfall to capture the window of time when there is an elevated concentration. The exact timing of the rise in concentration varies by watershed. This hydrograph from the Don River is provided as an example, where the 6-PPD quinone concentration increases 8 hours after the start of rainfall and remains elevated for 32 hours. Sampling should be timed to start after the rainfall to capture the rise in 6-PPD quinone. So this means sampling in dry weather on the days when you really enjoy being out in the field is not when you'll be out sampling for 6-PPD quinone. It will be probably during the rain event. If you sample during dry weather when there's been no rain, you'll miss the 6-PPD quinone peak in your stream or your watershed. One technique for sampling watersheds and stormwater is grab samples, which need to be timed appropriately with that elevated 6-PPD quinone concentration. This approach captures a snapshot in time of the environmental concentration, and recall that glass bottles are recommended for sampling 6-PPD quinone, and prolonged contact times with plastic should be avoided. So auto sampling is an advantageous sampling technique during storms because it can be programmed to collect discrete or continuous sampling over the entire course of the storm. Storms can happen at inopportune times like the evenings or the weekends or in the middle of the night. And automated sampling can be programmed to capture the maximum concentration and measure how long it remains elevated. So while the grab sample would indicate a snapshot, this technique would be the equivalent of filming a short movie. It can capture samples or time-weighted samples over the entire storm event. And a longer-term sampling tool to provide the time-weighted average concentration of contaminants is passive sampling. The passive devices are deployed in the field and left for days to weeks, and many are relatively affordable, and some mimic the bioavailability of contaminants. This is particularly useful for 6-PPD quinone that is transported during storm events and persists for only hours to days in surface water before settling to the benthic environment or being transported downstream. Preliminary investigations are underway to evaluate several different types of passive samplers for 6-PPD quinone. Currently available active and passive sampling approaches have been used to study air for 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone, and this is still a very active area of research. So after the samples are collected, commercial, public, and research laboratories are available for the analysis of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone in a range of environmental matrices. When selecting a laboratory, be sure it provides the analytical rigor required for program or project goals. Laboratory method accreditation, the method detection limits, sample holding times, and quality control parameters should be reviewed to ensure data will meet the desired quality and reproducibility. Analytical method accreditation requirements vary by state, organization, and agency. Stormwater and surface water contain a range of suspended solids, and because 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone can both sorb to organic material, it is important to consider if the measurement is providing the dissolved aqueous concentration, the suspended solid concentration, or a total, the dissolved plus the suspended concentration. For the measurement of 6-PPD, a standardized or approved method is not available due to the instability. Laboratories have investigated the use of ozone scavengers to increase stability and laboratory hold times, but they resulted in unstable conditions for 6-PPD quinone. Liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry, or gas chromatography, mass spectrometry are the common analysis methods and provide an estimate of 6-PPD. These are advantageous analytical techniques because of their ability to be adapted to biotic and abiotic matrices, the environmentally relevant low method detection limits, and the suitability for targeted, semi-targeted, and non-targeted screenings. For the measurement of 6-PPD quinone, an EPA draft method is available. Use of an approved method will depend on the goals of your study, but a standardized method reduces variability that could occur between different techniques. Method 1634 recommends collection in amber glass bottles, a 14-day hold time pre-extraction, a 28-day hold time post-extraction, and provides the total concentration of the dissolved plus the total suspended solid. The U.S. Geological Survey research method also demonstrates stability of 6-PPD quinone when freezing, which could increase sample hold times for laboratories. Research methods for other media have used a variety of extraction techniques coupled with LC-MS or GC-MS to provide concentrations in air, soil, sediment, tissues, food, and consumer products. So data generated from the mapping, sampling, and measuring can then be used with established modeling tools to predict the occurrence of 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. This can help to inform and focus sampling for hotspots near potentially vulnerable ecosystems and informing locations for mitigation. EPA tools for atmospheric fate and transport modeling have been applied to understand the emission and transport of tire and road wear particles. And recently, the VELMA tool was applied to 6-PPD quinone to predict hotspots and types of green infrastructure to reduce 6-PPD quinone. So bringing this back to this exposure model, occurrence, fate, and transport studies, along with mapping and modeling tools, have identified locations of potential hotspots for both 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone. All this data can inform the mitigations portion of the conceptual model to identify locations for source control and prioritize green infrastructure treatments that can most effectively reduce contaminant loadings to threatened aquatic habitats. And so now it will be my pleasure to pass this on to Mark, who will talk about the mitigations, measuring, and solutions, and also policies.
Thanks, Rachel. My name is Mark Schroeder. So yeah, as Rachel said, I'll be covering the mitigation, measures, and solutions, and then policies. To start, mitigation is the effects of 6-PPD and 6-PPDQ. Mitigating the effects of them requires the consideration of both near and long-term solutions. So the best approaches holistically protect both aquatic organisms and potentially even people should 6-PPDQ be found to have adverse effects on human health. So we'll be reviewing different types of mitigation measures that address 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone in multiple environmental realms. So we hope you'll walk away with knowledge on what mitigation practices are currently being explored, including ongoing efforts and research in alternative chemicals, stormwater, and sediments. The ultimate goal is to optimize the balance between mitigation effectiveness and the feasibility to have the widest reaching results. The longest term solution to mitigating 6-PPD quinone is the replacement of its parent chemical, 6-PPD. So we must ensure alternative assessments are thorough to avoid unintended consequences of new chemical substitutes. The National Research Council defines an alternatives assessment as the process for identifying and comparing potential chemical and non-chemical alternatives that could replace chemicals of concern on the basis of their hazards, comparative exposure, performance, and economic viability. This flowchart from California DTSC shows the life cycle at which these and other factors must be considered. There's been a lot of progress in just the past year in the intersection of policy and research, which we'll talk about in the next section. And right now the alternatives are being evaluated under rigorous criteria, considering that 6-PPD is vital for tire safety and performance. We also need to remember that the chemical is shed through tire and road wear particles, so we know that there will be widespread exposure to any replacement chemical. So in short, toxicity, performance, safety, and feasibility must all be considered before we can select an alternative. Next slide, please. Understanding and controlling the chemical sources are the first lines of defense in the near term. These near-term strategies are founded upon our understanding of how these chemicals move through the environment, like Rachel described earlier. Source controls are covered in the guidance document with examples such as alternatives to driving personal vehicles, like public transportation and walkable communities, addressing driver because driver behavior has a direct impact on the generation rate of tire wear particles with frequent or sudden acceleration, braking, as well as sharper high speed turns that can wear your tires out faster. There are emerging technologies with car designs that can capture tire wear particles. And finally, source control measures or actions in strategic locations that can control the load of tire wear particles into the environment and waters. On the next slide, I'll speak a bit to what goes into these SCMs, because the planning of SCMs are very significant for managing the transport into the environment. There's been a rapid response from stakeholders in moving many pieces of this mitigation puzzle forward simultaneously. The steps to stormwater planning might look like these four panels on the right side of the screen. 6PPD is incredibly unique in that it's both in the water quality assessment phase and it's also being considered in SCMs. So we must understand the contaminant fate and transport in order to engineer any mitigations. This includes the mapping tools or assessing water quality by characterizing the stormwater and identifying hotspots, and then planning for mitigation by determining which SCMs are effective, appropriate, and practical to maintain in each specific circumstance. After planning, implementation, and monitoring, the SCMs must work across local, state, federal, and tribal partnerships. And finally, there's a potential for remediation, which we won't really touch on in this presentation, but it heavily relies on any future policies. There are several types of stormwater SCMs that are projected to have a high probability of mitigating 6PPDQ. Variations of these three SCMs in the slide are predicted to be effective at slowing the flow of runoff and reducing or removing pollutants from stormwater systems because of the affinity for 6PPDQ to absorb to organic matter. On the left, we have source control measures that prevent stormwater contaminants from entering stormwater or storm drain systems, inhibiting their ability to enter and reach the receiving waters. These include street sweepings and the cleaning of roadside ditches or catch basins and storm pipes. Preliminary studies have intuitively demonstrated that increased frequency of street sweepings reduces tire wear particles in stormwater. In the middle, flow control SCMs can slow and reduce runoff volume through the on-site management of water. This method of management contradicts the design of many older roadways, though, where stormwater is flushed off the road into waterways quickly just to prevent flooding. And examples of flow controls include bioretention swales, infiltration basins, detention ponds, permeable pavements. And then finally, on the right, we have runoff treatment SCMs that reduce the concentrations of targeted pollutants through the means of either physical filtration or chemical sorption. To date, bioretention soil mixes, which contain a stormwater compost mix that is about 60-40 sand and compost, are identified as one of the most effective methods of reducing 6PPD quinone exposure and mortality in fish. Specialized high-performance bioretention mixes optimal for nutrient-sensitive water bodies are also showing preliminary promise. So pictured here is just an ordinary compost sock and a detention basin, and the affinity for organic matter has actually shown that it does a good job of filtering out some of these contaminants. Currently, SCM practice researchers are working on optimizing technologies for the most efficient and long-lasting SCMs and maximizing 6PPD quinone and tire wear particle removal. In 2022, the BMP effectiveness report published by the Washington State Department of Ecology examined existing stormwater BMPs to assess each for their potential efficacy at mitigating 6PPD quinone. The primary takeaway is that mitigation measures should take advantage of the chemical properties, as we remember that both 6PPD and 6PPD quinone have a high affinity to partition out of water and onto organic matter. Ongoing research is studying what happens to 6-PPDQ after it has been filtered out. There are a number of questions related to its remobilization and the maintenance of the SCMs. And there's more information in section 6 of this guidance document. Now we'll be discussing some policies, regulations, and laws that may have an effect on 6-PPD. So by the end of this section, we hope you'll gain an understanding of which federal policies, laws, and regulations might apply to its management, who the stakeholders for regulatory actions are, and what levels of government they can be found at, which states and tribes are currently driving the efforts towards regulatory actions now, and how nationwide awareness is growing and expected to trigger further federal actions. Section 7 of the guidance document identifies the many federal level regulations, policies, and laws that might affect the potential future regulation of 6-PPD, 6-PPD quinone, and tires. Only a select few legal governments are currently considering the chemicals, with the notable governances in the colored boxes. We have the tribal treaty rights, which supersede laws because they represent nation-to-nation treaties. Toxic Substance Control Act, the Clean Water, and the Clean Water Act. In addition, we've seen regulatory actions from states and tribes. And this isn't meant to definitively speak to any given entity's jurisdiction over an issue or decision, and just to highlight where much of the regulatory action is currently based. We'll begin with the TSCA case study and how it's closely tied to the tribal treaty rights. We want to emphasize the speed of movement comparatively and that this timeline is rapidly changing. On August 1st of 2023, a petition from Earth Justice on behalf of the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, the Port Gamble Tsklawam Tribe, and the Yurok Tribe asked the EPA to prohibit the manufacturing, processing, use, and distribution of 6-PPD in tires. The following month in September, the Affiliated Tribes of the Nor of Northwest Indians, ATNI, passed a resolution supporting the petition. And in November, the EPA granted the petition with the identified first steps to publish advanced notice of proposed rulemaking to gather more information, and then to final, and then at the end of 2024, or just last year, the EPA finalized a rule to require manufacturers of 6-PPD to report lists and copies of unpublished health and safety studies. The second legal governance is the EPA's response under the Clean Water Act. The numbers shown here are hazard-based screening values and are not enforceable standards. These values are the super low concentrations where researchers first see acute toxicity effects. Based on the available toxicity data for aquatic life, 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone concentrations below these values will not pose a significant risk to the majority of species in said ecosystem. Note that these values are conservative or lower than some of the concentrations noted in the toxicology slides. And if you recall from some of the earlier toxicity charts, those numbers are based off of the LC50, whereas the regulations are not based off of an LC50. As I mentioned earlier, Washington and California are working to address 6-PPD from multiple points of potential action. Among those actions include searching for a replacement to 6-PPD along, and California and Washington both have programs that are working alongside industry stakeholders to identify possible alternatives for 6-PPD. California does so through its Safer Consumer Products Regulation and requires an alternatives analysis to investigate safer alternatives to 6-PPD in tires. 75 tire manufacturers have completed a stage one alternatives analysis with 17 possible alternatives to 6-PPD, which is described in section 6 of the guidance document. Washington is working through the Safer Products for Washington program to review hazards and identify alternatives, both of which will inform the future rulemaking and restrictions. Washington's Department of Ecology is also completing an alternatives assessment using hazard criteria developed specifically for 6 PPD, including data requirements for sensitive species and other trophic levels. Effective policy development is closely tied to scientific research, which is still in its early stages. Significant knowledge gaps remain, requiring continued investigation to make practical regulations that can be implemented via SCMs or alternative chemicals. Some initial regulations have already begun, including stormwater permits with mitigation and retrofit guidance, as well as the EPA petition rulemaking. Alternatives remain the priority as mitigation effects are still in varying stages of research and early implementation. And our guidance document here, which has been linked in some of the Q&As, contains a lot more detailed information on the topics we've discussed today. We can pause here so you can use the QR code to get to it, or you can navigate to the website. And with that, I think I'll pass it back over and we'll answer any questions.
Mark, and to all of our speakers today, that was great, as always. And our subject matter expert, I'm going to go back to the slide so you have a chance to either scan the QR code or go to the document. Our experts have answered 16 questions so far in the Q&A pod, so I hope that you have been able to view those as they are coming through and encourage everybody. Go ahead and add any other questions here. We are at the end of the technical presentation. We will continue with some questions as we have them. So, give me a moment to get set and to put my subject matter experts on the spot. We still have some unanswered questions in the Q&A pod, as well as some answered and some frequently asked questions. So, let's get oriented. For those that are questions that are open in the Q&A pod, I'm going to ask the subject matter experts to let me know if there's any that we can ask out loud at this time and have a conversation around. But I am going to take it back to a base question that is asked a lot of the speakers, and I welcome any of the subject matter experts that we have today, our trainers and our folks helping in the background to come in and have a conversation. But one big question always asked of that group is 6 PPD used in other consumer products?
I can answer that, Nicole. So, yes, sneaker soles, doormats, garden hoses, knee pads, the little rubber, part of your faucet, in your kitchens or your bathrooms are just a few. And then it can also obviously be found in crumb rubber and playground mulch because those are made out of recycled tires.
Excellent. Thank you. And I know the guidance document has a section where lists some of these source information. So again, encourage you to visit that and take a look at the different sections. We are also often asked, and so let's just kind of dive into this a little bit. What is known about how an organism eliminates this chemical from their body? Alan shed a little bit of light on this, but maybe if somebody can point us to the section of the guidance document to get some more information.
I do know that's under study, and I'm not sure we understand entirely, all those pathways. We tried to bring that out in our training. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Lots still moving around. And a reminder that this document was completed in 2024. So I've certainly seen the ball move forward with additional studies. Mark?
Yep.
And this is where I'll chime in here that currently a data gap is the occurrence in biosolids. There's not a lot of data for that, and how much that contributes to environmental levels.
Again, looking for anybody to drop some additional questions into the Q&A, and I do want to make sure that our attendees have had a chance to look through the Q&A pod because we have been answering the questions as we go, and makes for great additional training material for you to consider through this course. Trainers, very few questions left here in the Q&A. I see some being responded to. I want to give you an opportunity to have the last word. Any additional comments or updates since the guidance document has been completed? I know we've seen several conferences on this topic, that we have subject matter experts from ITRC that have been traveling and helping to promote this guidance and the topic. And resolve some of the data gaps, but any other last words?
Yeah, I'd like to add an additional thought to we were talking about the depuration or metabolism of 6-PPD quinone and 6-PPD, and I'd like to point out that when we evaluate these kinds of contaminants, we sort of compare direct toxicity or even secondary toxicity mechanisms to bioaccumulation or biomagnification. That's a key distinction. So for 6-PPD quinone, we are pretty sure, based on the few studies that have been done, that it doesn't really materially bioaccumulate or biomagnify. It's more of a direct toxicity syndrome. So it and the half-lives are short, so that in a body or in tissue, it would metabolize relatively quickly, cause the direct toxicity, and then be metabolized. And so wouldn't be expected to bioaccumulate. Thanks for letting me add that.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Alan. All right, since we look like we're finishing up, I'm going to take the opportunity to use the chat to put the link to the feedback form. Again, scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll see the feedback form box. Fill out the information, and the most important piece for getting that certificate of completion is right next to the email. Check the box that says, I certify, I completed, and email address that you use will receive the certificate of completion. I think with that, trainers, thanks again. I always enjoy having these conversations together with you and hearing the updates on 6-PPD. Fantastic document. In addition to the document, please note on that website that there is a focus sheet. So if you're looking to share quick information with colleagues or project team members, please feel free to also promote the use of the focus sheet. It dives into the information at a very high level just to get an overview. All right. Well, with that, I thank everybody. I will keep this open for a minute to see if there's any other technical issues that need to be resolved. And from there, I will just say great job, and we'll talk to everybody again soon on another ITRC webinar. Thank you.